Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. The war in Ukraine has now entered its fourth week, and what began as a massive Russian invasion of Ukraine has transformed into a bloody, grinding siege of Russia's western neighbor. In our last episode, I spoke with Michael Kaufman of CNA about the military dimensions of the conflict and about the erroneous assumptions, expectations, and ideas that fueled Russia's decision to go to war. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, I highly recommend that you do. It's a terrific explainer of how we got to where we are today. In this episode, though, I want to focus on the West's response to Russia's aggression, specifically the economic sanctions and pressure that are now facing Moscow. We have witnessed a remarkable show of unity in recent days from Western governments, as well as multinational companies. Many of Russia's financial institutions have been disconnected from the SWIFT transaction system. Oil majors like BP and Shell have pulled out of their respective projects in Russia. Companies like Apple, Nike, and Adidas have suspended sales of their products there. And financial institutions like Deutsche Bank have wound down their business in the country. As a result, Russia is heading into economic isolation and economic stagnation similar to what we saw during the Cold War. What might that mean for ordinary Russians? How does this alter Russia's place in the world? And where does that leave Russian President Vladimir Putin and his neo-imperial ambitions? To get some answers to those questions, I turn to Bill Browder. Bill is the CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, the head of the Global Magnitsky Justice Campaign, and the author of the best-selling book, Red Notice. Bill was the largest foreign investor in Russia until 2005, when the Kremlin declared him a threat to national security for exposing corruption in Russian state-owned companies. For more than a decade, he has been the most visible and vocal global champion of what are today known as Magnitsky sanctions, named after the lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, who uncovered massive fraud by the Russian government, was imprisoned as a result, and died in detention. Bill is, in a word, one of the world's leading voices on Russia, on sanctions, and on the future of Vladimir Putin's regime. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Freezing Order, which will be released on April 12th and tracks the money laundering and illicit financial activities of the Putin regime. Bill, it's terrific to talk to you.
Great to be here.
At this point, it's pretty clear that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was driven by mistaken assumptions on the part of Vladimir Putin. Assumptions regarding the resolve of the Ukrainians, most of all, but also about the likely response from the West. That response, however, has been tremendous, and it's involved an unprecedented raft of sanctions against the Russian government and Russian banks. Can you walk us through what's been done so far on that front?
Indeed, it's been unprecedented, the level of response of the West to this horrific war of aggression by Vladimir Putin. I should just say that, first of all, the West has never responded in any way even close to this. And Putin has committed other atrocities, not quite as bad as this, but invading Georgia, taking Crimea, shooting down passenger planes, assassinating people, et cetera. The sanctions that have been imposed start with his rainy day fund, the central bank reserves. He thought he had $640 billion at the central bank that he could use to fund his war, to tide him over if there's any rough spots. And completely out of nowhere, and this is something, I'm a sanctions expert, and I didn't think of this and I never anticipated this, but the major Western allies, the US, the EU, Canada, and the UK, got together and froze those central bank reserves at their respective central banks. And so Russia has lost access to about $350 billion. And then the rest of the money is either held in Chinese currency, which is not all that valuable, or in gold, which is hard to transact. And so effectively, their whole rainy day fund, the whole central bank reserves, have now become effectively useless. On top of that, the sovereign wealth fund has also been sanctioned and frozen, and so there's no access to that. Then we get to the commercial banks. There's a major sanction which has rarely been used. It was used on Iran back in the day, which was disconnecting banks from the SWIFT international payment system. When you disconnect banks from SWIFT, it basically puts a country back to the dark ages. And that's what happened with Iran. That's actually probably the single biggest catalyst that brought Iran to the negotiating table. So far, we've disconnected 70% of Russia's banks from SWIFT. Now, there's still 30% to go. The Europeans insisted on those 30%, so that's still in play. I think eventually those banks will also be disconnected. Then we move on to the oligarchs. So we've now gotten Putin's money onshore, or I should say his central bank reserves taken care of. And then we have to look for where does he hold his personal fortune, which I estimate to be $200 billion. And the answer is that he holds it through the oligarchs. And we've now started to sanction the oligarchs. Now, there's 100 oligarchs in total who matter. These are the richest oligarchs in Russia. We've only sanctioned about 20 of them so far. And so a lot more need to be sanctioned. But the ones we've gotten have been some of the really high value targets. Roman Abramovich, Oleg Deripaska, Peter Avin, head of Alpha Bank. And moreover, what's very interesting is that even the oligarchs who haven't been sanctioned are now having trouble moving their money around, getting access to their money, conducting business, because nobody wants to be seen to be assisting Russians evading sanctions. And so my prediction is that all 100 oligarchs will be eventually sanctioned. But in the meantime, the entire class of elites in Russia are completely under the gun. And then the fourth sanction is not something that the governments of the world have imposed, but the private sector has imposed, which is a complete disengagement from Russia. And so from BP, Shell, to McDonald's and Microsoft, everybody has withdrawn from Russia, more or less. I think there's probably, I would say, maybe 20% of the companies remain. And every company that remains ends up under huge moral and business pressure to withdraw. And as a result of all these sanctions, we're now in a situation where it's projected that the Russian GDP will shrink by 30%, which is just extraordinary. 30% GDP contraction is equivalent to what the US experienced during the Great Depression. And I'm the first to criticize governments at being too weak and trying to be seen to be doing things and not doing things. But I would say in this particular instance, I would praise the US government, the British government, the EU, in being really tough and hardcore. And this has created a real problem for Vladimir Putin.
Energy is a major factor here as well, of course. And we've long heard talk about Europe's unhealthy dependency on Russian energy, most recently in the debate over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Things are changing on this front as well, though, aren't they?
Energy is definitely the weak link, if there is such a thing, in terms of surrounding and isolating Russia financially. There are countries like Italy, which receive 100% of their natural gas from Russia. Austria is in the same boat. Then you've got Germany with 40% of their natural gas. And so it's unrealistic to ask them to stop buying Russian gas because they need to find an alternative. This gas is not something you can just change overnight. You need pipelines and supply sources and so on and so forth. And so that is a weak link. And it's also an important link because that's probably the main source of revenue for Russia. So even if we've frozen all of their assets, there's still cash flow coming in. So a few countries, the United States, Canada, and Great Britain have said that they're going to stop buying Russian oil. And it's easier for us to say that than for Germany, because, you know, I think in the UK, it's like 3% of the total oil. And I think it's a not too dissimilar amount in the United States. So we're not taking such a hit. But I think that Europe is going to have to quickly change. And they're talking about changing. Germany, who had built the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to effectively become more dependent on Russian gas, and by the way, squeeze Ukraine in the process, because Nord Stream was, the purpose of it was to bypass Ukraine. That's now canceled, which is good. And then Germany is also saying that they have to reorient their energy supplies. And when they say that, I actually believe it, because Germany is a country that gets things done if they decide to put their mind to it. And so I would imagine in 2 or 3 years that the number will drop precipitously from 45% to a much, much lower number. And that will have a very negative impact on the cash flow coming into Russia.
They always say that on the battlefield, the adversary also gets a vote. So I wonder if you can talk for a minute about how the Russians are responding, how they've responded historically. I know you have a book coming out next month on the illicit financial dealings of the Putin regime. How does that play in here?
the most important thing to understand is that the reason for this war is because Putin is a kleptocrat and he's stolen an enormous amount of money and he's afraid of his people overthrowing him, as they did with Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan and as they tried to do with Lukashenko in Belarus. And so the original sin which led Putin to war was all the money he stole. And by the way, when you're afraid of losing power, what do? You start a war. It's not a war about NATO. It's not a war about Ukraine. It's a war about not being overthrown, not being thrown in jail, and not having all his money taken away. And what I learned over the last 12 years, which I've written about in my book, which is coming up on April 12th, is how Putin went about stealing the money, where it was laundered, and how it was laundered. And the book goes into great detail that nobody knows anything about. It's the big secret of Russia, is how Vladimir Putin launders the money. And when you finally get to the end of my book, it's like a light bulb. It's a light bulb for me writing it and thinking about it, which is, it's all about money. This whole thing is all about money. It's all about dirty money. It's all about money laundering. It's all about how the West has become the accomplice of Putin in taking all the money away from the Russian people.
And that brings us back to the current war in Ukraine. I'm curious as to your thoughts, as someone who's watched Russian politics for a long time, who's been involved in dealings with the Kremlin, what does all this mean for the regime of Vladimir Putin? Russia's president rose to power as an autocrat capable of safeguarding the economic and the political interests of a small clique of immensely powerful and immensely wealthy individuals in Russia. The war has impacted these people directly, although, as you say, there's more that still can be done. Already, we're seeing that it's isolated them internationally. Is Putin's regime in trouble as a result? Are we on the cusp of seeing some profound change in Moscow?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of people fantasizing that if you impoverish the oligarchs, they'll rise up against Putin. And my analysis is that's not going to happen. The reason it's not going to happen is that the oligarchs are all existing purely at the pleasure of Vladimir Putin. At any point, with a quick stroke of the pen, he could impoverish them, imprison them, or kill them. And so none of them have the guts to stand up to Putin. They're just hoping that somehow they can survive. And yes, they have been impoverished. I mean, the value of their Russian shares is down 98%. And the value of their foreign holdings is effectively zero because they have no access to it. And so this is a total catastrophic economic situation for the Russian oligarchs. The regime itself will either become dramatically weaker or potentially dramatically stronger as a result of this. If Putin were to succeed in Ukraine, he wouldn't stop with Ukraine. He would then move on to Estonia or Lithuania or Latvia. And he'd point his guns at those countries and point his warheads at London, Berlin, and Washington, and then ask us whether we really are serious about Article 5 of NATO. Are we really ready to go to war? Would we be willing to do that? And his bet is that we wouldn't, that when it came to a big debate in America on CNN and on Fox and on all other news channels, Americans would say, well, wait a second, why don't we just like make peace with this guy? And the peace that he'd like to make would be the peace where we redraw the map of Russia up to the German border, the 1945 map. That's his fantasy big win scenario. The big loss scenario, which was recently elaborated by Francis Fukuyama, the famous political scientist, is that Putin is actually losing this war very badly, that the Ukrainians are immensely more powerful than we anticipated. The Russians are immensely less powerful than we anticipated on the battlefield. The Russians are experiencing unbelievable losses, and that eventually they will be wiped out, that they will lose the war. And if Vladimir Putin loses this war, then the whole image of him as the strong man disappears. And if the strong man image disappears, then his power disappears. And that's when he gets wiped out. Now, I would not predict either of those two scenarios. My most likely scenario is something which is along the lines of a constant, ongoing, low-grade, horrific conflict where people are dying every day. Nobody has won, nobody has lost, and it just carries on.
All right, I want to shift gears for a minute because, as you know, this podcast deals mainly with media and disinformation. So I'm curious as to your views of that aspect of the current conflict. We've seen a tremendous amount of fake news coming out of Russia regarding the war. the reasons for it, the Kremlin's objectives, and so on. There's also a steady diet of disinformation being directed at ordinary Russians themselves, which really bears no resemblance to what's actually taking place on the ground in Ukraine. What's the Russian media message about the mounting sanctions, though? Do ordinary Russians really comprehend what's happening?
Sadly, ordinary Russians are fed a completely different narrative. If you're living in Russia right now, you're told this is not a war. This is not an invasion. In fact, anyone who uses the word war and invasion is now a criminal offense with a prison sentence up to 15 years. What this is being presented as to the Russian people is that this is a special operation, that the Ukrainians are nationalists, fascists, and Nazis, and that they are doing horrific atrocities in Ukraine. This is a humanitarian exercise to save Russian-speaking people from these terrible Nazis. And remarkably, because Putin has shut down every outlet of normal truth in reporting, 75% of the Russians believe him, to the point where you have family members of Russians in Ukraine under shelling on the phone telling their relatives in Russia what's going on. And their relatives say, that's impossible. I'm watching the news. It's just not true. And so you have a country which is supporting its president because it looks like a different thing. And you have a country that's then furious with the West because why are you punishing us for just doing a humanitarian mission? And what they're thinking is, Putin is saying this, that these Westerners are just trying to degrade Russia, to try to hurt us. We need to stand tough. We need to tighten our belts and we'll get through this. And that's his message. And nobody has an alternative message because there's no information for them to get.
And on the sanctions specifically, do the Russians understand what's happening? They can see it on the street, of course. They can see it in the stores. They can see it in their bank accounts. But in terms of the scope of what's actually happening and what's been arrayed against the Russian regime and against the nation, do they understand?
I think that very few Russians understand the scope of what's happening. All they see is things have gotten a lot more expensive in the last 3 weeks. They can't get any money out of the bank. They can't use their credit card anymore. That all of a sudden, McDonald's no longer serves burgers and Netflix no longer shows films. And so it's all very discombobulating and upsetting. And the smart Russians, the people who are in the intelligentsia, who are in the opposition, they've all fled or are in the process of fleeing. You know, we talked about the 2.5 or maybe 3 million Ukrainians who have fled. There's 200,000 Russians who have fled. And they're not being bombed. They can see the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall is that it's going to be a total iron curtain, that you won't be able to leave. You won't be able to come in. You won't be able to use your money and convert your money. They'll probably renationalize all the companies. And so the average smart Russian says, I don't want any part of that. I want out.
One more question on media. Over the last 3 weeks, we've seen a remarkable European focus on narrowing the scope of Russian disinformation, and the Kremlin's main propaganda channels have been banned from the Eurozone. But if history teaches us anything, Russian propaganda isn't going away. Rather, it's going to adapt to these new conditions. So what do you think is coming next in terms of Russian messaging?
Well, the Russian propaganda machine is a very adaptable machine. They duck and dive and dodge and weave. And so they are going to take advantage of wherever we give them the opportunity to take advantage. They'll take advantage on Facebook. They'll take advantage on Twitter. I'm a big target of the St. Petersburg troll factory. And they've, if anything, increased their trolling, not decreased it. Apparently the trolls must be happy to be paid in rubles because they're not getting hard currency anymore. And I think that the other thing which is happening is that they've successfully, up until today, commandeered the far left and the far right in various countries around the world, including the US. You still have Tucker Carlson spouting Russian propaganda, and you have Tulsi Gabbard spouting Russian propaganda, two people on the opposite ends of the political spectrum. This is something that goes on around the world, not just in the United States, but in Great Britain and France and so on and so forth. Marine Le Pen, who is the probably most likely challenger to Emmanuel Macron, openly has taken money from Russian financial sources to fund her campaign.
Okay, so what's next here? It's unclear where we're heading in the current conflict or whether there's a feasible de-escalation scenario. President Biden has already made clear that the U.S. isn't interested in fighting Russia directly in Ukraine, but in preventing Russia from moving beyond Ukraine and threatening NATO member states. What more can and should be done to accomplish this? Are we using all of the coercive tools at our disposal? And what's your recommendation?
Well, I think that this idea of constantly repeating that we don't want to go to war with Russia is the most destructive thing we could be saying. If we think that, we should just keep it to ourselves, because by saying it over and over again, it's saying to Putin, that's fine. We can carpet bomb and massacre all of Ukraine. We can go after Moldova. We can go after anybody that we want, and you'll do nothing because you made this commitment that you're not going to do anything. It's absurd. Back in the Obama days, we were saying we wouldn't supply even defensive weapons to the Ukrainians because that would be crossing a red line. Of course, now we're doing it. I mean, I don't think that we should be so gingerly tiptoeing around Vladimir Putin. He only understands hard barriers and true force. And I think that the only moral thing that we can be doing right now, and we have to be doing, is we have to set up a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Everyone says we don't want World War III. Well, does he want to engage with us in World War III? I don't think that we should be so timid about this whole thing. We have a massacre going on in front of our eyes. We've said this before, never again, never again, never again. We have a massacre going on in front of our eyes of Ukrainians by Russia in a totally unprovoked war of aggression. And it just seems to me that we should do a no-fly zone, and we should do it in the same way we supplied offensive weapons. And we should understand that by doing so, we're actually making ourselves safer, because it lowers the probability that we ever end up in a situation where he then starts to invade Estonia, Lithuania, or Poland.
We'll have to let that be the last word. Bill, thanks so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.